Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the stuff I've seen since the last time I did one of these. I am David. Tyler is, of course, still not here. He's making slight progress. You can find out about that slight progress, and you can also hopefully find a link somewhere to the GoFundMe at caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. I'll say it again. It's caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. Go check that out if you want to know what's going on with Tyler and how you can help. All right, it's been a while since I did one of these, and though I have seen a ton of movies, they're not all movies I'm going to talk about on here, because a lot of them are Sundance movies, and you'll have a Sundance wrap episode coming in a few days, and then also preparations for our next profile. So luckily, despite the long break, this can still be kind of a brief episode. Let's start with a documentary directed by Shanak Sen, and it's called All That Breathes. Actually, as of this recording, it was just recently nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary. And I loved it. It's gorgeous. It's more along the lines of the kind of documentary that I like. Yes, it's about something. It is a profile of two brothers in India who run a out of their garage on the roof of their home, a sort of sanctuary hospital rehab facility for kites, the birds, not kites, the plaything that the birds that are called kites. So there's definitely that human interest element, but it doesn't come across as that kind of isn't this cute type of documentary. It's a portrait of passion and obsession and family, but it's also a portrait of New Delhi. There's so much naturalism to it, and it doesn't feel like Shanak Sen laid this all out beforehand, which is the kind of documentary that often kind of gets on my nerves. It does feel like he went in with his eyes wide open and just put together something that beautiful that he found there. So highly recommend All That Breathes. Next up, even though it's a brand new movie here, I rewatched Marie Kreutzer's Corsage because I love it so much. I think I loved it even more the second time through. Vicky Creeps is amazing. The movie is very funny, but also a portrait of depression. A weird comparison that came to mind actually when I was watching it this time is, of all things, BoJack Horseman. And I probably was thinking about BoJack Horseman because I often am, because I think it's a great show. But in the sense of this being a look at someone who's very severely depressed, but also has the money and status to do whatever they want and wallow in whatever way they want, and it can be funny, but they can also be cruel. Obviously, the movie's not quite as absurd as BoJack Horseman, but it's not absurd at the same time. So, absolutely beautiful movie. Glad I watched it again. Movie I watched for the first time, Michael Grandage's My Policeman, which I don't know. I feel like it got I don't know if it was just the pile on of anti-Harry Styles stuff that came in the wake of the Don't Worry Darling fiasco. But I feel like this movie got largely dismissed, and it's not here to tell you that it's like a secret hidden gem, but it's not at all a bad movie. Harry Styles plays a policeman who strikes up a romance, I guess, with Emma Corrin of The Crown. But he's really carrying on a closeted, surreptitious sexual relationship and romantic relationship with, like a museum docent or something, played by David Dawson, who's great, by the way. But it's Emma Corrin is really kind of the lead character, and it's a very sort of tragic romance type movie in many ways, and multiple types of the multiple romances in this movie are tragic, in which Emma Corrin plays someone who is very much in love with her husband, but has spent her life more or less knowing that he's married to her as a sort of front, even though, and he has a lot of affection for her, but it's not what she wants. Meanwhile, the policeman and the docent also have a tragic romance because of the laws at the time it takes place in, like, is it early 60s? I think it's late 50s, probably into early 60s. Yeah, there are lots of reasons they have to stay closeted, legally and everything else. So, I think the movie is definitely better than its reputation. Harry Styles is definitely better. I haven't seen Don't Worry Darling, but he's definitely better than people are making him out to be. A lot of that is the chemistry between him and David Dawson. I really believe these two are into each other. All right. Next up, the first of two Lena Dunham movies I'll be talking about in this episode, the better of the two, Catherine Called Birdie. I haven't read the novel. I will admit that until this movie was announced, I didn't know about the novel. But I found the movie, the Bella Ramsey is the actress who plays Birdie. It takes place in the Middle Ages, and she's a young woman, or I mean a girl, but in the eyes of her father, played by Andrew Scott, a young woman enough to be married off, hopefully to someone rich to save the family's fortunes. But she's, you know, I'm sure it says in the movie how old she's supposed to be, but 13 or 14, she, you know, gets her first period during the movie. So probably maybe younger, I don't know, I feel like maybe back then, did people age differently, or maybe not? Maybe it's the opposite, because people didn't live as long. I'm off on a tangent. The movie is has a lot of intentional sort of anachronisms. It including like the music is all, it's all 90s songs, but it's modern day. It's one artist, I can't remember her name, doing a bunch of 90s songs like Mazzy Star and stuff like that. And so it has this kind of this modern cadence and lexicon to it, but not in an overly arch or annoying way. It feels appropriate to the age group. It feels like it really feels like you're in this young girl's head and is making you realize or think about the fact that despite her circumstances, which are scary, being married off, but also like she's a woman of privilege, she's comes from a family of, I guess they're like landed gentry. I mean, I don't know, I'm not sure how all of that works. Well, I guess he's a lord. Yeah, so she's nobility. Anyway, this is not important. But it is important because there's like the privilege. So it's weirdly a companion, like a different type of take on what Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette is exploring, the like distance of wealth and aristocracy, but also the humanity of a young woman or a girl who is being whose life is being dictated for her. So I mentioned Bella Ramsey and Andrew Scott. Also, Billy Piper plays her mother. Joe Alwyn plays her uncle. Sophie Okonedo plays a nearby noble. Paul Kay, as he often seems to have to do, plays a boorish piece of shit. David Bradley plays an old codger like he always does. It's just got a great cast. It's very funny. You know, it's a reminder that like Lena Dunham is funny. I don't know that I would go so far as to call her a comedian, but humor has been a part, comedy has been a part of her work as long as she's been making work, and Captain Calberti is very funny. All right, next up is Park Chan-wook's decision to leave. I loved this in a way that is I almost take for granted maybe with someone like Park Chan-wook. Like he's one of those filmmakers that I go into one of his movies feeling pretty confident that I'm going to have a good time, and I do. Although, you know, good time is a relative term. The movie is very sad, but also with some dark comedy. You know, there's some upsetting stuff in it. It's very sad, but it's also funny. It's about a detective who is investigating a woman whose husband died in an accident, perhaps. Maybe she's a suspect. He doesn't think she's a suspect, or maybe he likes her and is convincing himself that she didn't do it. Well, you'll have to see the movie for yourself to find out. But the loneliness and sadness of and longing of the main character, especially Hae-jun, played by Park Hae-il, is very touching and moving, but also Park Chan-wook's the precision of his filmmaking and the beauty of his frames and his editing. He does feel like it's interesting, I think, to acknowledge how our values as cinema lovers seem to be changing. You know, I was having this conversation with my wife, getting far afield here, but that's what we do on this podcast. I was having this conversation with my wife about that we live in a world where a legacy Top Gun sequel gets nominated for Best Picture. But I don't have a problem with it, because Top Gun Maverick is great, and also great movies like that, you know, like great big budget studio action movies used to be more common and less remarkable. And so part of why something like Top Gun is so beloved is because that kind of filmmaking has become more rare, and in its place has been this sort of very franchise minded, very CG aided sort of amorphous type of filmmaking that doesn't feel, you know, everything's green screened and pre-vised and fixed in post and all of this stuff, and everything seems so fake and weightless and empty now that something like Top Gun, that feels like a real goddamn movie, feels like a revelation. So to come back to Park Chan-wook, it's interesting to see, and part of this is just that he's been around for so long, but, you know, 15 years ago, Park Chan-wook was seen as like being on the cutting edge, you know, something like Old Boy was like for, you know, adventurous film lovers, at least here in America, only. And now Decision to Leave, without that much having actually changed about his filmmaking style, Decision to Leave feels like such a work, such a classical work of filmmaking. It feels like it's rooted in a time when it wasn't just, making films wasn't just about, I feel like such an old man, but this has really happened where, you know, the things that, you know, you're appealing to a smaller base and a more rabid base, so everything has the sort of like, or a lot of things have to have the sort of like franchise fandom type recognizability, and that is more important. Those moments, those like, you know, cheering in the theater or gif-able type moments are more important, and filmmakers as talented at actually just construction, just presentation construction of a movie, are less thick on the ground in terms of mainstream entertainment. In Decision to Leave, obviously there's a barrier, less so than they used to be, but in America there's a barrier that subtitles represent, unfortunately. But the guy who made the Vengeance trilogy made something that feels like the most old Hollywood piece of classical, beautiful, mainstream, grown-up cinema. Anyway, I hate to only be talking about a movie that I love as much as Decision to Leave in terms of what it is not, you know? And I've done that a lot with Top Gun Maverick as well. I should also just be focused on what Decision to Leave is, which is just an absolutely gorgeous story of longing, and risk and sacrifice.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right. Next up is, oh my gosh, the rare movie, the very rare movie that gets hella hyped up and then actually ends up being as good, if not better, and I would say probably better than the hype made it seem. I finally, after months, caught up with Zach Cregger's Barbarian. And I'm sure anyone listening to this has probably already seen it and is like, yeah, welcome to the party, pal. But it rocks. Barbarian is so cool and so inventive and creepy in the way, both in its content being, you know, having actual surprises, but also creepy in its presentation. There's a lot of just really just scare inducing, but like not like jump scare, not that there aren't jump scares, I don't have that much of a problem with jump scares, but there's also those like dread inducing type of drawn out shots and uses of framing and shadow that are all really, really great. It's also Tyler and I have talked about this before. Zach Cregger comes from the world of comedy. He's a sketch comedy guy, and much like Jordan Peele. And it's interesting to see how comedic instincts translate to horror instincts, because the Barbarian's also very funny at times. But Zach Cregger also knows how to get a genuine reaction out of an audience, and he uses it for both laughs and scares. I also want to point out how, because there was also another movie earlier in 2022 called House of Darkness, and Justin Long was in that too. And it's very interesting to see that Justin Long, who was like once the cute but awkward boy next door, you know, the nice kid, and he still has that, but there's two horror movies in the same year in which he gets cast as someone who's a misogynist, like, piece of shit. And I do wonder if the things we've learned over the past 5-6 years, or, you know, men, women already knew this, but the things that have become more public over the past 5-6 years about what kind of men are doing the worst things and being the worst, that it's not the obvious, you know, brutish bad guy. Like, the nice guy can also be a piece of shit, and maybe is more likely to, because of whatever he feels he's owed, or however he feels he's been wronged by being the nice guy. Not that Barbarian, like, or House of Darkness, not that either movie, like, lays into that too thickly. They don't have to, because they cast Justin Long. And a lot can be said for the power of casting. So yeah, that's Barbarian. Then I watched, I guess this is also a horror movie. I mean, not that it's very scary, but that's probably where it would be classified in the blockbuster. Peter Strickland's Flux Gourmet, which is another one of his oddly, like, alternate present science fiction type of, not even science fiction isn't like the word, but just like speculative alternate reality fiction. It takes place in a world in which, and now I've already forgotten what they call them, culinary performance artists, or they have a name for them, but there's an entire genre of performance art slash music that has to do with mixing food with the performance, and the sounds of preparing food with the music. This movie takes place of one such band has been granted a residency at sort of a retreat slash performance space where they get to do nothing but work on music and go through walks. But the main character in the movie is the videographer who works for the retreat. It's hard to explain, obviously. I mean, I just did a lot of explaining. It's hard to explain even beyond that what the conflicts are. Gwendolyn Christie plays the woman who runs the retreat, who butts heads with the sort of front woman of the band, played by Strickland regular Fatima Mohammed. Other people, Asa Butterfield is in the band, is the other big name, but there are a lot of tensions among the band, among Gwendolyn Christie and the band, among the videographer. There's also a physician played. He's really great. Richard Bremer is the actor, and he's fantastic. Yeah, it's the movie is very tense. Obviously, it's very weird and sometimes very gross with all the food. And I don't know if you're grossed out by like people doing things with food other than just like cooking and eating it, which I sometimes am. There's a lot of the movie that's gross, but it's also really transfixing and beautiful and sometimes violent and bloody. Yeah, it's only the second Strickland film that I've seen. I need to go back and see. What was it? Barbarian Sound Studio was the first one, but there's another one I missed, but I saw In Fabric. The Duke of Burgundy is a big one that I really want to see. But I liked In Fabric. I would say I really like Flux Gourmet. I think it's my favorite of the two of his films that I've seen so far. All right, then I went to Sundance. Let me skip ahead a little bit to just my last couple movies. So I saw a documentary. This was aired on PBS as part of Independent Lens, I think, and it's on the PBS app. I'm not sure if you have to be, like me, a monthly donor to see it, or if it's available to everyone on the PBS app. But the movie is called I Didn't See You There. It's a documentary directed by a guy named Reed Davenport, who lives in Oakland and he lives in Oakland and he I don't know if he has cerebral palsy or something. He uses a wheelchair and has a very distinct and somewhat difficult way of speaking, and he moves involuntarily. And he's making a documentary just carrying a camera around through his daily life, but also it's while the circus is in town in Oakland. So he keeps coming back to the history of freak shows in the circus as a way of, so between that his point of view on the legacy of freak shows and seeing, because he's never, that's a big thing, he's never, his face, like you see a little bit, like maybe his arms here or there, you see his feet at one point, but he's generally not on camera, but his voice is there the entire time. He is sometimes difficult to understand. There aren't subtitles, and I think that's intentional. So between him talking about freak shows and him shooting from his point of view, from a moving, you know, he has a motorized, wheelchair, the task of a personal documentary like the documentary like this, of getting the audience to see things the way the filmmaker does, this has got to be one of the strongest examples of that I've ever seen. I found it incredibly moving and eye-opening and almost reality altering in the way that it got me inside this guy's experience. Not that outsider thing of like, you know, look at this poor guy. It's not making you sympathize with him. It's just making you see the way he does, and maybe even a little bit feel the way he does. One thing that really stood out to me, you know, as he's a filmmaker, I'm sure, you know, he probably shot a lot of footage. The movie's only like 80 minutes long or so. So it's, you know, whatever he decided to put in it, he clearly put in it for a reason. And it's interesting how rarely, if ever, we see people being cruel to this man. Instead, what he really focuses on is the people being going out of their way to be polite, going out of the way to be helpful, or assuming he needs help. And there's a certain, like, there's a humanity to him understanding, I think, that, you know, these people aren't being jerks, but there's also a patronizing aspect that becomes clear pretty quickly, in the way that we experience him being treated. It's really a truly powerful and singular film. I Didn't See You There. I would definitely recommend, if you have a way to see it, I would definitely recommend seeing it. And then we're going to end on kind of a down note for me, the other Lena Dunham movie from 2022, Sharp Stick, is about a woman in her 20s who works as a sort of, nanny / governess, I guess, to disabled children. And she's in the house of this one couple played by Lena Dunham and John Bernthal. And then she starts to have an affair. She's a virgin. She's in her mid-20s. And she has an affair with John Bernthal. And it kind of opens her world up to sex. And again, there's a lot of funny in it. It also has, I mentioned Lena Dunham and John Bernthal. It also has Taylor Page and the great Jennifer Jason Leigh. Scott Speedman has a small role. Even Moss Bacharach has a small role. There's a lot that's good about it. I do think Lena Dunham was a good filmmaker. But the main character, she's played by Kristen Froseth, and I don't really want to sound like I'm blaming her. I think it's more the main character as written. I just kind of found her annoying. Her naivete, like, borders on, I don't know if it's a pathology or if she's sick. I don't know. It's upsettingly, she's upsettingly childlike and annoying, and I found it unrealistic.